Good morning. Is this on? Yep, good deal. So excited to have you. Another good start to another good morning. One more tomorrow. So looking forward to what we're going to hear today. So let's start with our prayer on page 3. If you have the book or in your Hoover app, and we'll pray together. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Loving and gracious God, we ask you to open our hearts to your Son's life and ministry and to answer the call to be his disciples. May our response be rooted in the gospel. May we be ever mindful of the needs of our communities. And may our stewardship flow from a profound sense of gratitude for your many blessings. By the gift of the Holy Spirit, empower and inspire us to respond in a way that brings hope to others and reveals the love that comes to us through Jesus Christ. We ask this in his name, who is Lord forever and ever. Amen. Excited to hear the session today. Is going to talk about what's happening in Memphis, and really looking forward to our discussion today. So we're going to hear from Bishop David Talley. He was ordained a priest in Atlanta in 19, I believe, 89, and then he became auxiliary bishop in Atlanta in 2012, and then moved to Louisiana in 2016, and then 19 became bishop in Memphis. So he's been there for 5 years. And then he has with him two of his team. David Zielinski is the CFO of the diocese. David Zielinski is here. And then Margaret Scott is works with the bishop in his office. And then joined by Michael Goodwin with Guidance and Giving. I've known Michael for the 27 years he's been in and running and working in his company, Guidance and Giving. They've probably done over 40 diocesan capital campaigns, including, we're going to hear from Memphis, and probably over 600 parish campaigns. And he's been a partner of ICSC for all his 27 years. So grateful to have Michael here, Bishop, David, and Margaret, and it's all yours. Welcome.
Okay, yeah. Not that Bishop David and I need a microphone, because we can easily carry this room. But for the taping purposes, they'll want us to do this. So at any rate, what I'd thank you all for coming. I'm just going to give you a little setup of kind of what we're going to do today. As you'll notice, there'll be no big bells and whistles. I don't really need that. I've got Bishop Talley beside me. If you're enthusiastic enough, we can definitely get David to dance. He's a great dancer. Only CFO you'll ever see that dances as well as he does. But basically what we want to do today is kind of tell the Memphis story. And it's a story that kind of started out in a real rough patch. And I'm going to let Bishop talk about that between COVID and some leadership issues when he took over there. I will say a little piece of knowledge I figured out by when I worked with Bishop to talking back and forth, and he described a lot of what he did in Atlanta when he was a pastor in Atlanta and how he kind of ended up going to various parishes that seemed to have some issues and some things that people needed to be brought to day. So I said, so you were one of those fixer pastors. You were one of those guys they sent to the problem spots. He goes, yeah. I go, so that's what they expected here as the bishop going to Memphis. He's like, yeah, that's kind of it. So I'm going to let Bishop tell this story and the rest of the crew here. But what we want to do is really just focus in on how, with a capital campaign, with these type of things, they're always the money is like kind of preeminent in people's minds. But the reality is that the money's important, and we're going to do a lot of good things with it, and we'll get to the point where we pop the champagne and we all pat ourselves on the back and tell each other how what a great job we did on a successful campaign. But the reality is it's so much more than that. And a good campaign is so much more. It's a foundational piece of what needs to be done. And it's a way to grow. And it's a way to bring the diocese together and to do a better job of defining what diocese is. Because our people desperately need that. We are exceptionally parochial in our view, and we get that. That's important. That's where people receive the Eucharist. That is their home. It's always going to be paramount. But how do we start to cooperate together, to see needs that extend beyond our boundaries? So, and I thought as we were thinking about these things, the best way to do that was to bring the Memphis team out and to talk about those things. So we're going to do a little bit. I'm going to prompt a couple questions to ask them to talk, but we're really going to do the bulk of this entire discussion will be yours. It'll be questions that you have and things that you want to learn, or questions you're experiencing or challenges you're experiencing in your own diocese. So with that said, I'm going to throw it over to Bishop Talley to kind of give his perspective of as he came into the diocese, where things were, and everything kind of leading right up until we did our feasibility study.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. What he said is the truth. What guidance and giving did for us and with us through the gift of the Holy Spirit helped to bring a unifying principle to Memphis. But let me start this story before I was in Memphis. I was in Lilburn, Georgia, in the Archdiocese of Atlanta, in a parish that desperately needed a new church. I'm going to exaggerate because I don't remember the number, but it was something like 12 masses on a Sunday. Because we had a cracker box church, and it was an exploding population. It's lower middle class. This was not one of the yuppie suburban churches in Atlanta. It was lower middle class with a regional school. Two of my buddies had been sent there as pastors back to back, and they had been run out. Two of my friends. It was factions, tons of factions in this parish. And it was a big parish, but it was just very tense. They all know they wanted the church, but they all wanted it in their image and likeness. So two of my buddies left. They called me to do this. And right. And I didn't have a clue, but I saw the wounds. And so we interviewed about 10, just a ton of teams about looking for money. And I was, excited about this team. I can't tell you all the things, but they came in and they came in. And I'll talk more about this in their Memphis phase, but they came in and by the way they work, which is relational, by the way they work, they built relationships up in Lilburn, Georgia. And factions slowly began to talk to each other because we all wanted the same thing. We needed a new worship space. We needed money to do it. And we had to cooperate together. And so they began a relationship, and we raised exactly what they told we were going to raise, and we built a beautiful new church. Fast forward. I'm in Memphis in 2019. In 2019, I was sent there, and all of you remember, and this is just past history, there was leadership problems there. The bishop had been removed after 2 years. In his final year, he transferred 70% of the priests, 7-0. And so the priests were all confused and hurt. There were wounds there. And so I was sent there. And right after I came, we had COVID, which really helped a lot. You know, we weren't talking to each other. We were seeing each other, and we were separated and angry and upset and all that sort of thing. And so people in the chancery said to me, you know, this is a great time to do a feasibility study for a capital campaign. And I said, you got to be kidding me. COVID, where you wear masks everywhere. But they said, yeah, this is the time. So they had a couple of companies, this one, and they came back to us and said, we can do this. I didn't believe it. But I had that experience of guidance and giving in Atlanta. And what guidance and giving did in Atlanta was build relationships where there was friction. And so they began. And it was an extraordinary watching them. We needed the money. Yes, we're all about the money. Memphis is a small diocese with lots of challenges. And we needed this. We had no endowments. We're 50 years old, and there was not any endowment system in Memphis. We were living hand to mouth. We were living offertory. You know how bad that is. And we know we needed buckets. We needed to invest money. We needed that sort of fundamental change in the way we perceive finances and stewardship, but it hadn't happened yet. They came in, and what Michael and his wife Christine, who was significantly better at part of this, this couple, Michael and Christine and a bunch of extraordinary young workers came in, and they became part of us. Examples. When we had trivia night at one of our parishes, they would show up and kick butt. They were wonderful. They would come to our dances. They would come to all of our masses. They would talk to people after masses. Not about the money, but about Memphis and about who they were and how they knew the Lord. It was truly relational ministry. And along with that was, how do you want to see Memphis flourish? What can Memphis do now? What are your needs? And with all of that, we had five buckets. Four buckets. I wanted five. We didn't get five. Yeah, they said no. So,
there was occasionally some collusion.
But what I want you to hear is, and I'm, he won't do it, but I'm selling this way of being, fundraising. It's about seeing Jesus of Nazareth, not as an idea, but as a person who is attached to us, who is with us. And he calls us to be his light. He calls us to rub off each other about the love we long for, about the kingdom we hope for. And that's what parishes and dioceses are all about, proclaiming a kingdom that is becoming. Not yet fully realized, but it is becoming day by day. And when we live that life, that relational life of love, great things happen. They will tell you the biggest, bigger parts of success, but success was 30 million. We looked for 22, which I thought was a stretch. We got 30 million pledged, and the, what do you call that rate? What is that?
Redemption,
redemption rate is exactly, it's up here. I was scared to death. You know, I said to them, I said, yeah, they said, it said 30, but when do we get it? And he said, the redemption rate was right up here, and it's been right there all along. So for my part, I want you to hear from me about this company and about how they understand this ministry. And it is a ministry. It is building relationships with a local parish, a local diocese, to find out who they are and what they long for, and helping us to realize what needs to happen, which is that growth of the kingdom of God.
Great. David, you want to?
Can I
love that.
Yeah, can I pass?
No.
Okay. Let's see, Bishop Talley hired me about 5 months after he got there, and I had been with the, thank you, I'd been with a parish, and we really didn't like the chancery. I mean, it was the Death Star, as we called it, because there was information in, but nothing coming out. Cash going in, we didn't know where it went. It just was, there was no transparency. And when I interviewed with him, I'd had a car wreck that morning. Do you remember that?
No,
that and I showed up anyway. I rented a car and showed up anyway.
That is so cool.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But the guy that did before him was younger and with over
better looking.
Yeah,
better looking.
I don't know. Okay. but we interviewed him and he was the better take.
Thank you. So when he hired me, he said, we're going to work on transparency. And that's what we've really tried to do. If you go to our website, we've got audit reports on there. We've got where the cathedraticum is spent. We've got where we spend our annual appeal. I've got pie charts for every parish and what they're spending. So for like 4 or 5 years worth of history. So we're trying to show if we spend a dollar, where we spend it. And part of that was with guidance and giving folks. When they came on board, they were a big proponent of transparency. And so we talked about it, and as Bishop said, we had never had a foundation. We had a couple of small endowments here and there, but not anything coherent. So we promised the people that we would put together a foundation and that we would open endowments. And so it was just a confluence of great events. We had a bishop that everybody liked. We had a team that were going to raise the money that everybody liked. They did the analysis, and the four buckets were no-brainers. It was seminarians, retired priests, deacons, and youth ministry. Who's going to argue with that? You know, we didn't say we're going to go do something crazy with it. And then we were going to open a foundation and put four endowments in it so you can see it growing and you could see it coming out and putting it to work. So with Bishop Talley's vision, with guidance and giving's vision, we were very, very transparent, and it was a rousing success. People were coming out of the woodwork, and I even was a believer, because before taking the job, I was thinking, oh man, let's see what we can do over there. But the culture has completely changed, and people know what we're doing, and they follow Bishop throughout West Tennessee.
My turn. Good morning. So I'm kind of the lay perspective of this whole thing. I also am the one person at the table that worked under the previous bishop. So the previous bishop hired me, and 6 months later he was gone. And that very day I was asking the administrator, as well as the Episcopal administrator, as well as the chancellor, do I come to work tomorrow? Because I had no idea how this worked. I had moved to Memphis to help take care of my parents, had been out of the church for a long time. But my dad was a deacon. I'm a deacon's kid. And so I called up the chancery and said, hey, can I get a job? So he hired me. And I've told Bishop David several times, you're lucky he hired me, because you probably wouldn't have hired me. But anyway, you know, 6 months later, the bishop is gone. And a few months later from that point, Bishop David comes in. And the day I met him, I was like, this guy's the real deal. And as David said, that moment where we realized we had a bishop that everyone loved, and that that was going to be the leading driver of what was to come. And, you know, guidance and giving coming in, I will tell you, I go to one of the parishes that had, before we actually started all of this, they were actually starting their own capital campaign. And it was seamless when guidance and giving came in, and it was just all included. They did a combined campaign, but it was seamless to the people at the parish because guidance and giving was there for all of us as well. So it wasn't as if we were separated out. You're doing your own thing, and then guidance and giving is doing this. It was just all part of the same thing. And I think that was a real big piece of how this all came together and worked well. And in this whole process, I know that Michael is going to start talking a little bit also about, you know, he talked about it being foundational and the starting point. And, you know, one of the things that we're doing now, I'm excited because I know so much more having worked with them and now being part of what the diocese is doing now, that I know so much more about what stewardship means, and that it's not just the money, but it absolutely, we're all about the money, yes, but it's also about all those other things that we give. It's the time and the talents. It's not just the treasure. And I think those are the things that, as a foundational piece, that treasure allows us to be able to focus on the time and the talent. And I think that's just really a beautiful thing. And so, pass it back.
So, Bishop, if you would, just give a little bit, because first of all, in the description, we have your favorite rallying call. Exactly. So I'm going to have you get into that a little bit. But could you just... talk a little bit about those steps that you started to take, even prior to the campaign coming to fruition, and things that were taking place, actually, some of them, while we were starting the campaign, but just ways that were centered around building the community, as you said.
Well, with Margaret, who is my executive assistant, keeps my calendar and helps me load it up. I loaded up. What I began to do is, this is the honest truth. I know lots of bishops, just extraordinary men with extraordinary talents. I don't have those. But I have a few things that I know God has given me. And one of them is a real love for people, a longing, to find, a building of love between us. And I wanted to do that. And I couldn't do that by staying in the chancery. So I was gone all the time. I'm in the parishes. I want to be in the schools more, but I'm in the parishes all the time. There had been a tradition of bringing everybody downtown to the cathedral for confirmation. I stopped that, and my first year I visited 47 parishes. And the next year I visited 47 parishes and 47 parishes. So I see them all the time because, again, and please don't be tired of the word, because it's central to me. Relational love is everything. And guidance and giving allowed us to understand the building of the Church of West Tennessee relationally. It's a love making of the Spirit, where we cooperate with God's desire, and God's desire is that we're happy and joyful and holy together. So I began to visit the parishes. I began to bring together the priests. I started a convocation that was mandatory. I told them, if you're not going to go, you got to write me and tell me why. And they didn't write me. They all came. And we began to find a new level of fellowship. And we began to talk to each other, even the factions that didn't, you know, and we had that in the church. You all know that, but we tried to bring it to the center, which is Jesus of Nazareth. And in doing that, and in the constant reaching out to them, I have seen how things have gotten better. Not perfect, but better.
So you got to tell them about Adam one day.
Huh? Well, you know how it is with when you're within your parishes or in your families, when you know there's something to be done, and you want to wait around for perfection before you start. And we can't wait for perfection. We have to start, because it never gets done unless somebody pulls the trigger. And that's what adelante is. It means going now. Don't wait. And so holiness, adelante. Pull the trigger. Say today is the day that we have to change who we are with God's help. And so, and I got most, not all, but most of the priests began to believe in that. And they saw guidance in giving. And the way guidance in giving worked with us relationally is a way we are starting already. We are building a new West Tennessee by this campaign, by this effort.
So our joke with our staff was, if you find yourself in any setting, finance councils going after you, pastors angry, whatever, just start yelling adelante. Just keep saying it, you know. It just every sentence start with adelante. So it became kind of our internal campaign, but it was a true feeling. And look, the bishop is being much kinder to us than I had actually anticipated or wanted him to be. So much of this is really due to these steps of healing his presbyterate from all the pain that had occurred with previous leadership. And that was his first step. And a Eucharistic Congress and getting out to the parishes. David's got the perfect thing. It was confluence of great factors. People were ready to be done with COVID. People were ready to be done with being locked up. I mean, so our receptions had attendances like I've never seen. I told the bishop, I said, it's either your popularity or these people are so bored that they will come to anything that's out in public. So at any rate, I think that, but so much of that and so much of what we were able to key in on and messed perfectly with our style, as the bishop so eloquently says, of relational fundraising, was just that core belief in mission. You know, oh, there we go.
Yeah, sorry. No, you did. And you all know this. You know how we have built, we live in silos. We live in self-enclosed little environments of the people who think just like us. And we call that church, or we call that country. We are so isolated one with the other. And the internet only makes this worse. It heightens our sense of being alone and dealing with the world outside of us. And that's not the way of Jesus of Nazareth. He's a bridge builder, not a wall builder. He tears the walls down. The walls of sin or confusion or being lost or despair, or any of those things that we've all experienced. But the Lord, the Savior, is there here in this room saying to us, now is the time to break down the walls and begin to build the bridges one to the other. Men and women, young and old, red states and blue states, all of that together. And our people were ready for that. And again, this focus on being with us in a relationship with the Lord and with his church, it was the confluence that clicked.
I was just thinking about something that happened with the bishop's leadership. The way our fundraise worked, guidance and giving calculated a goal for every parish based upon historical giving patterns. And the first dollars that came in paid for our annual Catholic appeal that year. We did not run one separate. We just rolled it together. And then after that, it was 50-50 between the chancery and the parish until they hit their goal. And then the split would change. And we were having conversations because a lot of times, once they hit their goal, instead of 50-50, the chancery gets 80% or even 90% or sometimes 75% of the goal, and the parish gets a smaller percentage. And we're talking to the bishop, and he says, yeah, I want the parishes to get 75% after we hit the goal. So, of course, I don't hear this. I hear we're getting 75%. And he had to repeat it because this is the leadership that he has, that he listened, and he knew that the parishes needed to be healed as much as his presbyterate. So when they hit their target, say they're raising $1 million, once they get to $1,001,000, they get to keep 75 cents of that dollar, and we took 25. So this wasn't a big get rich quick scheme for the diocese. It was, it truly was a cross the aisle fundraise for everybody. And when he says he went to 47 parishes his first year, that's all we have. He went to everybody. So his, the style of our fundraise reflected his vision, and the partnership we had with guidance and giving were certainly malleable to go ahead and help us achieve what we're trying to do.
I do. And Margaret, make sure, because we'll talk, and I'll say, where am I? You know, and she'll say, no, we got that. And so, no, every year we do 47 parishes. And oh, I've messed up. I have missed seeing all the schools because it's tough. I've missed some of the schools, but we're trying to do that. And what I'm doing now is, some of you would know a canonical visit. What I'm doing now is I'm going and spending a full weekend at parishes, and I'll meet the pastoral council, the finance council, all of the lay leadership, the staff, all the clergy, and do the masses and meet people afterwards. Because our people don't know what a bishop is. We are so parochial. We've lost our Catholicity. You know, there's West Tennessee, and it's one church. I'm the successor of the apostles who Francis gave to West Tennessee. Yes, I have 47 pastors helping me, and they do great work, but we have got to see the both and. It's one church. A diocese is one church with your shepherd, and that shepherd has 50 or 100 priests assisting him in shepherding. But what we can't do is get rid of that one church piece. And me going out there and seeing these people and talking to these people, I hope it helped that.
And I think, and we're about to go to your questions that can be very specific to your situation and just kind of our reaction to it and things. But I think the key part of this whole thing is when your fundraising is about mission, okay, not necessarily the outcomes, not necessarily the money needed. You need all of that. We need the transparency. People need to be very clear. But the reality is what gets people to truly give, it's the whole message of this conference. I mean, not about the giving, about everything. But the point is when people buy into the mission, when people believe that this is an important step for us to move forward, to build the kingdom, to answer what we need to face as a church, that's really the key to it all. And so we try to make, from our perspective as the outside council, look, we're the people that are rolling in this suit and tie there to take all their money. Okay, that's what they see when we come through the door. Now, we have learned to dramatically change our attire based on the diocese we're in. Steve Schoen's back there is the development director in Fargo. I don't think I've worn a tie to a meeting in Fargo in a year and a half, including my meetings with the bishop. Okay? There, you show up out in a rural area, farm, in a suit and tie, and they'll be like, no, go. You know, so staff loves it. I mean, khakis and shirts have become, you know, the thing. But my point is that when you're able to ingrain yourself into the parishes and to the diocese to become part of that community, you know, our staff is encouraged to, you know, have office hours at every parish they're working with, have go to they love it especially. What is it with the men's groups in our church that they have to meet at 6 a.m. on a Saturday? It's got to be a survival of the fittest type approach. So my young staff has a tough one with that one, but they're encouraged. We go out to those, the Knights of Columbus, the various ministries. The point is we're trying to meet people where they are. You know, I know that's an overused term, but that's the term. We need to meet them where they are on this journey. We need to walk with them on this journey. And that means adapting in every situation. And I would, so for those of you that are involved with fundraising, I think that's the key. The key is as best you can to be adaptive. Be adaptive to the needs. You know, make sure you're reflecting what's required out there. And when you're able to do that in a process, the easiest way for me has always been to do that is to go back to the mission. Why are we here? What is our purpose? That is what draws us all together. And it's not an easy thing to do, but it's an easy concept to build on. So look at all the things that you do when you're out there raising money, building community, those type of things, and think about that, because that's what guides us. People will give you enough money to fix the hole in the roof, okay? But they're not going to give you more than you needed to fix the hole in the roof. The only way to get people to be generous with their giving is it has to be about something more. It has to be, how are you building the kingdom? How are you leaving for future generations? So with that, what I'd like to do is just kind of open the floor up for any questions that you have, just about any of these things, about mission, about, you know, any of the pieces that sparked an interest. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. We're in the Diocese of Charlotte, which now is over half Catholic Hispanic, and they're first generation. We have found that if we start with the personal encounter, what you're saying, we use the retreat, the road to Emmaus, you know, and really work on that. We have an untapped sort. Everybody's generous. They know how to take care of their parish, their families, everything. This guidance and giving, I've already Googled you, so I'm going to find out more and be in touch. But my question is, or just my desire is, do you guys, can they work with small, like a segment of the diocese, or is it everybody? Maybe I should be asking Jim, because he's our development director. But anyway, I see what you're saying. Our faithful Catholic Hispanics started to build a retreat house and then surprised us with it. So of course there was no permission from the diocese, but it's an extremely huge project, which if we had a capital campaign would probably amount to millions of dollars. They're doing it on their own. That's the untapped potential, because they had the retreats. They wanted to come together. They see it as their form of discipleship.
So how do you guys work with Latinos in the diocese? Speak to that.
I can project.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. So first, to recognize how we have failed in this creativity. While I was in Atlanta, in Alexandria, and Memphis, I know that pastors have a tendency to a status quo tendency. And the envelope system has been our bread and butter forever, and so it's always going to be. And the people in the conference tell us no. The envelope system is not going to be there forever. That population is graying. We have to hear other ways for stewardship. For the Hispanic populations in Atlanta, they will do a kermesse and raise tons of money. If they don't fit within a guideline, this is not now. Years and years ago when I first started, we made them go through this rigorous guideline about how to raise money. It ain't going to work. But if you let their leadership, as long as there's just some transparency here, if you let their leadership guide their community, great things can happen. Yeah, great things can happen.
And more specifically, at least for our approach, because it's an essential approach everywhere we go. The outreach to the Spanish-speaking community is huge, and I think last year's session that we did like this was specifically on that, so I could do a whole session easily. But my point is, going back to what I originally said, it's all about meeting people where they are. And if you do not meet the Spanish-speaking community where they are on their journey, yes, we would all ultimately like to have people. When you go to Texas, we worked in Houston, we've worked all over Texas, you have fifth and sixth generation Spanish speak. They're still going to mass in Spanish because that is where they love. Their English is better than mine, but they still worship in Spanish. In those situations, the normal pledging works. The normal everything works. but we can't expect people to go from here to here. It's the same thing with the stewardship journey, right? First time you hear a stewardship message, you're not expecting everybody to yell, "Eureka, stand up, I got it, and now I'm, you know, giving five," you know, whatever. It doesn't function that way. So we meet people where they are. One of our key things is, and it's a term we use, we don't translate. We create. We have bilingual people. We create it in Spanish. They write it in Spanish. They don't translate it from the English, because anybody that knows Spanish will spot it instantly. So we're very, and same thing as the bishop would say about the graying. It's about young people. Millennials. Your millennials, they're at the age of people are coming back to church traditionally. This is when they're having children. This is when most of your millennials have never written a check in their life. So why do we want to give them a complicated pledge card to fill out? It makes no sense. We're not meeting people where they are. They want to give, but they're in the moment people. They're quick. You don't catch them in the moment. They're on to something else. You got 50 seconds to make your message. So whether we like that or not, whether we want to wag our finger at them, no, let's figure out a way to get to them. And that's whether it's digital. So there's a lot of different ways. And I promise, I used to joke with the bishop. I said, I always take the first question at a reception, because sometimes receptions can be a little tough. And I take an easy question and take forever to answer it. And then nobody else is afraid to ask a question at that point. So I don't want that to happen here. But those are just a little bit of what we try to do. So yes.
You mentioned the four buckets. I think I only heard three, but my question is really not so much about what the buckets are, is how did you get the buckets? Did it come from synodality and conversations with the parishes, or?
Yes. And a feasibility study. We went out and met with every pastor, 50, 60 lay people.
It wasn't.
Yeah, I said, we did a feasibility study also. So there were things taking place at the diocese that were building towards this. We went out, met with every pastor in their parish. We met with 50 to 60 lay people. We did electronic surveys to everybody to get those type of things. So it was built on that. But I always say with a feasibility study, it's not a popularity contest. It's not a vote. It's got to be strategically what the diocese needs.
But in addition, thank you for that question, because we were conscious in telling our people this is not a top-down proposition. I didn't come here 6 months ago and now give you my vision of the Church of West Tennessee. What do you say? So we did that. All of it. We didn't call it synodal, but we were doing exactly that, listening to the population.
When we did that, we also were surprised at some of the results, because with a feasibility study would have a bunch of options for people to choose. And we knew there was a couple of things in there that were going to get selected, and they did not. So that tells you that how important the feasibility study is, because we think we know what's going on. And we probably could have picked these four, but we might have gone to six. But the other two didn't make the cut in the conversation. So the feasibility study was extremely important.
Hi, Becky Pugh from Diocese of Great Falls Billings. I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about the timelines of what it was that you were doing and how long you were doing it, particularly around the fact that you were repairing relationships and trying to just prepare people for a capital campaign. And so what were the time frames for maybe some of that pre-work, then the feasibility, et cetera, and how long did it take for you to actually reach and pass goal?
In that answer, talk about leadership gifts, how many folks Bishop visited, that kind of stuff, too.
You go.
Well, I want to make sure I get the pre-stuff. We were basically for about a year and a half, 2 years after you arrived that we did the campaign, correct? Okay, so we talked already about some of the steps made was out and listening, Bishop getting out, healing the presbyterate was a key part. That was the convocation part of it. You know, in other words, healing the brother priests even before we start really going into the major outreach. It all kind of, those 2 years culminated with the Eucharistic Congress in the diocese.
The first in 50 years.
Yeah, and a procession and
Oh. It was
I think it was a hotel downtown. It was about 3,000 or 4,000 people, first time, and it was a joy. We didn't have any of the gigantic names coming in. It was just kind of regular people talking with music and praise. The key of it, though, is we had this enormous procession through downtown Memphis to a historic St. Peter's. The oldest parish we have is Dominican Parish, and we had benediction there. But we had those drones. Thank you. We had the drones overhead, and so we had in our website. The drones, it showed this gigantic snaking worship through downtown Memphis. So that was part of it.
Yeah, and that really kicked us off. Our whole staff was there for that. I've never participated in something in my Catholic life that was as beautiful as that was. That procession was unbelievable. First of all, God smiled on us with the weather. We had the most beautiful sunset that I was actually hitting behind the church as we got to the church, you know, from the long walk. Everybody was there. It was a sense of joyousness. I knew at that moment, I knew it from meeting with the pastors and how positive they were about Bishop Talley, that we were in good shape. I knew at that moment, I'm like, we've got 3,000 people down here doing it. We're going to be fine. So that was all a lot of the things that were taking place in the bishop's presence. We did a feasibility study over a 6-month period. Okay, that we went out and met with everybody in their parish, and did a lot of that work. We put together the report. We presented to all the priests and the presbyterate, bishop. We kind of came up with the campaign. We took about 6 months to get it started. That's where the major gifts came in, the leadership gifts, as we term them. We had 3 or 4 gatherings that we spur off. Our method is, we had a couple people we approached individually that were, but this was a diocese that the Catholic givers were not indoctrinated into giving. I mean, the large givers, this, they had never had the outreach. They had never had. So part of what we knew we needed to do is we needed to get this man and his personality front and center to as many people as we could. So much of what we did was based on bringing lots of people in, people at his home, and we would then follow up with them. Bishop made, I don't know how many visits. I mean, when the first visit you make in a $22 million campaign gets $2.5 million gift, that can usually inspire some confidence. I'll never forget his face when they told him that. but at any rate, we did that. We did a lead, and that was part of the lead gift lead up to it. And then we broke the diocese into 2 6-month blocks. It's 47 parishes. They had tight geography. This isn't like Fargo where we're just driving for days and days and days and days and then a few days after that. You know, and then once we're done that, another couple days. It was tight geography. We did 2 6-month blocks. We both broke the diocese in half. We did the campaign. We did a 4-year pledge. We're approaching the 4th year of pledge for the first block of parishes. And the redemption rates are right on schedule to get in around 93-94%. And I do want to touch on that because there's a reason for that. And it isn't our great techniques or, you know, my great personality. Great. Well, it's because what we asked people to do was meeting the need that they had. It was asking people to support their faith. It wasn't going there and, you know, we're going to do a bunch of well screening and we're going to hit, you know, send our pastors out with 15, you know, numbers to ask people and you're going to sit one-on-one. When people make a gift to our campaigns, it is thoughtful and prayerful and they follow through on it. And it's part of our messaging. It's different than some. I'm not saying better, worse. We like it. It's the way I like to operate. It's the way we operate. But we like to meet those people and to do that. And so that's part of why I think the redemption is so strong, is because the manner in which people are being approached. And that I think is the key.
Does guidance and giving also take care of the redemption phase?
We don't take care of redemption. However, we do make sure that we've worked to set up the redemption and that they have something in place. We worked in Memphis very strongly on the communications that took place. For about 2 years, we kind of handled a lot of the communications about the campaign. It's now gone. The diocese is handling it now. They weren't really staffed up to make that happen. So a lot of the just keeping people aware of what's going on electronically and through newsletters. But we monitor. I get reports every week from the diocese, but we don't necessarily do, you know, the nuts and bolts of it.
But they were there for us when we had questions. When I came, we didn't have a CFO, we didn't have a communications officer. There were a couple of big people, big posts vacant, and as they were ramped up, we did a better and better job in ourselves, but they were always there to answer my questions.
Do you have a director of development at this time?
Still
looking?
Still looking. Okay. Great vision.
There's a question.
Just saying. Cost of living is low.
Did you have planned giving as part of your campaign? And if so, how did you account for that on your totals?
The question about planning, this is a great question because this is a question that I believe in sometimes in some other campaigns, the way planned gifts have been accounted for have caused a lot of problems at the end of the day because that's not money that's actually in hand. And so big giant numbers are put out that isn't the cash in hand. We also know, unfortunately, and I'm not downplaying planned giving, believe me, I'm about to give a little pep for it. But the reality is, you know, estate gifts and things like that are made, that are wills and things like that sometimes get counted in these situations, those have a very low level of ever actually coming in. I mean, they're not as strong. That is not to say that we haven't totally missed the boat as Catholics in planned giving. We haven't had the endowments in place. We haven't had ways to do those things. It's essential. What we promoted there, because once again, going back to the foundational piece, we didn't have any planned gifts that were part of our campaign. We had multiple people that were very interested in planned gifts. And what we did was by establishing these endowments, establishing this foundation, we're now giving people an opportunity to give to these things. And that's part of where the diocese is going next through the development world is to build on what we've learned in the campaign. And that's where planned giving in this case came in. And some dioceses, they might be very far down the road of working with planned gifts, of sophisticated development. Then it becomes a bigger part. We as a firm only count it as its entirely separate entity that never goes into our totals. You know, it's just a number that's out there. But I do think that it's an absolutely essential thing. And it's something that, you know, more and more dioceses are coming to. And it's a good way. You got to remember when we do a capital campaign, when you do a capital campaign in diocese, you have a better opportunity to communicate your mission to each parish than any other way you can do it. You can have all the newspaper articles. You can have all the websites and all the bells and whistles. We're actually taking the message to the people in the pews at Mass, in receptions. We've got the bishop going around. There's no better opportunity to communicate. And planned giving is part of that.
Other questions? You get one? You have one here.
Since you didn't have any endowments historically, did you find that you had to educate your priests or your people in the pews about how endowments work, why it's important? We have a foundation that even though it's been around for 30 years, no one knows it exists. And so we're finding ourselves even just like in that phase of like, this is what an endowment is. This is how it works.
Thanks.
Yes. We have great priests. I'm not a business type. I learn from people. Most of my priests are not business types. We love the Lord and we know we need funds to make parishes grow, maintain parishes. But for West Tennessee, we haven't had that foresight, that visioning of what we should be. And by God's grace, a confluence happened where we're now looking at the world that way. Stepping over the here and now, and the here and now needs of the people, but saying, I keep telling my personnel board, we can't just fill slots. We have to think in 5 and 10 year increments. The same thing about our financial status. I have to think way after I'm buried in Calvary, we have to think about the church, how it's going to live, in a time where we don't have the same kind of offertory. And it's through these endowments, these buckets, where we allow money to grow with us through the generosity of others. So you're right, and it's an ongoing education.
I will say, though, that some of the higher net worth individuals are very familiar with it because they give to universities, that sort of thing. So there was a lot of positive feedback from some of the high net worth people saying, well, it is about time that you guys did this. So now it's a matter of getting everyone on that same page so they understand it. Because I try to tell a pastor that if you have a Zaleski family that's giving $5,000 a year, you can sit down with them and talk to them and say, hey, can you leave $200,000 in your will for us? We'll put it in the endowment, pull 5% out, you get $5,000 coming into St. Anne Church for the rest of time. And I think that's a good story that we have yet to embrace and push out there.
And I think when you were talking about the fact that you've had it for 30 years and people don't know what it is, I think that whole concept of legacy is about adult education. And adult education means you got to repeat, because we tend to forget. And so there has to be, even with us having our endowment now, it's a short time frame for people to forget, oh, I forgot we had endowments, right? And so 30 years, you have to keep repeating because that's what creates the legacy.
I'd just like to, and here's a great idea to take back to your diocese, and I wish I could take credit for it, but in 30 years of doing these diocesan campaigns, I've never seen this case item until we are in the process of starting a campaign in January. It will be our first block in the Diocese of Savannah with Bishop Stephen Parks. One of his main case items he wanted tested was, we will be doing a $30,000 endowment for every single parish and mission in the Diocese of Savannah as part of the capital campaign. So, it's 57. Now, we're going to do it even. We had a meeting of our priest advisory council. We talked about this. They have about 6 parishes that have large endowments in the whole diocese. Everybody else, nothing. So even missions, even very small missions, we're going to do this. The reality is that amount of money is just a little over $2 million out of a campaign that will raise 25 to 30. The other advantage it allows the larger parishes are the ones that are going to disproportionately give to the campaign because they're going to give more, their goals more. They are, in effect, funding this through the larger parishes, because you always get that, the rich parishes, the rural parishes, and they got lots of small parishes, pastors with 2 or 3. So just, not the Memphis story, maybe in 2 years, the Savannah story, it's a great idea, and if you really look at the numbers, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of funding to pull it off compared to the amount of funding we're going to do for other things. And what a great legacy to say to people, we believe in your future. We are going to help establish that. There is reason for hope. You know, we're entering the year of hope. That is our theme. That's going to be our campaign theme prominently. But the point is, so a little digression there, but it made me think about it with the endowments. It's a great idea.
Maybe 2 more questions. Anyone else have a question?
Bishop, I apologize for asking this question, but the Diocese of Memphis has an exceptional bishop, as you've alluded to. What do you do in a diocese where the bishop does not have the heart for the campaign that Bishop David has?
First of all, this was a dream. All right. Starting with him, we're working with Bishop Fulda in North Dakota. If anybody knows him, same thing. Out in the parish, great man. Bishop Parks, as a Catholic, 57-year-old Catholic, gives me great hope for our church. So yes, there are guys. There are other guys that do not have the heart for it. It is not, and they don't even want to. Those campaigns are always going to be tougher. Chances are, unless you build a beautiful case and, you know, a perfect case that hits. But still the point is to try to get, utilize the bishop in a way that he's comfortable with. He doesn't necessarily have to. I loved following this man in a reception. He'd get them all wound up. I'd get in there and keep getting wound up. My wife, who we talked about, she'd say, yeah, you two are great. They're all excited. They're ready to run and charge out. They have no idea what they need to do. You've got them all excited, both of you. They're worked up, but nobody knows what needs to be done. And so then she would come in afterwards because we would invite her up and say, Christine, you want to come up and talk about what we missed? And she's like, yeah, you got a half hour because they missed it all. But the point is, you know, try to get the bishop what he does well and try to build on that and build the best you can and recognize that our job as development people, you know, we don't get the perfect, you know, hand dealt to us. We have to make the best of it. You know, we have that team. That's your team. You got to take them. You got to do what you can. And so we just really try to isolate that. See if there's, you know, sometimes there's a particularly beloved older priest that's able to really help. And sometimes it really just, sometimes in parishes where you just don't have the pastor and you're not going to have him, nothing you do is going to change that. Then it's about, can we get to the people? You know, because we know our message is good. We just need them to hear it.
One more question, and then we'll wrap up.
I think actually you might have just answered it, Debbie DiCarlo from the Diocese of Phoenix, but you mentioned the importance of building that bridge. And my question was, because we have a bishop who came in, he's also been there 2 years now, and he really, I think, believes very similarly, and he's building lots of bridges. But we do have some pastors that just are not interested in crossing that bridge. And so I was just wondering if there was an approach that you took besides persevering.
I don't have there's no magic answer except to persevere and to believe in the goodness of God and that, our lacks, and once we recognize them will always be made whole by the mercy of God, the goodness of God, just to persevere there, because in my 36 years, there's no magic answer to that. There's some of the brothers who are just phoning it in and you all know that. And we have to pray for them that they will learn to be a bit more intentional and a little less automatic.
Let's thank him. So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say real quick, one of the main things was the convocation. The bishop kind of blew by that pretty quickly, you know. But the reality is getting the guys in a social situation. And then I saw it whenever we got the priest all together. There were not the usual pockets of priests. Everybody was kind of mixed in, and I think that was huge. And one last thing I do want to say, the diocese, not only did they take this campaign, but they are taking the next steps. You know, Dan's here right now. They've been doing a strategic planning process that they're well into coming out of this campaign, capitalizing on this good spirit, this feeling of success. So taking those steps forward, what does the foundation need to look like? What does ministry look like? So I'm at the end. I thank you all so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank them. Yeah, stay around. So again, evaluations on Hoover, fill them out. The exhibitors, go visit them now if you could, and then 10 o'clock's our next session. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks.